The Public Safety Committee will come to order. We've got three bills on the agenda. We're going to try to get through them as rapidly as we can. The first bill is House File 88, Representative Detmer. Representative Detmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
And I'm just not exactly sure. Does this bill need to go anywhere else besides here? Mr. Diebel, do you know if it needs to go anywhere else? I'm sorry? Does it need to go to the Committee on Veterans Affairs? I don't.
Mr. Chair, no, it wouldn't have to.
Okay. Then why? Okay, apparently Representative Hillstrom would like to see your bill, so I guess the motion would be that it would be moved to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. I'm not sure what impact it would have on the courts, but so would someone like to make that motion? Representative Schoen is making that motion. Representative Detmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. First time before this committee, obviously. I do have an oral amendment. You have a letter from the Minnesota State Bar Association that suggests that I have an oral amendment. Could I make that at this time?
Yes, please.
If you take a look on, if you have the bill in front of you, line 1.13, it says establishing by the production of delete A, the letter A, insert the person's most recent, and then continue certified copy United States Department of Defense DD-214. So just eliminate the word A, the letter A, and insert the person's most recent.
Okay.
The reason is that in the military, obviously, my years in the military, you receive several different DD-214s based on your active duty service, and we want to make sure that we specify it's the most recent DD-214.
Okay. So, members, just so we're clear, on line 1.113, delete A and insert the person's most recent on line 1.13 and then the rest of the sentence. Is that correct? Any discussion on the motion by Representative Detmer? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now the bill is as you wish, Representative Detmer?
That's correct, Mr.
Do you want to briefly explain it and then have your witness?
We take a look at this came through the Military Action Group, which is a nonpartisan think tank for military veterans issues. The people that attend these meetings are the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs Office, Military Affairs, the DEED, MenSCU, the Governor's Office, Secretary of State, Ritchie makes our meetings, and also the Minnesota State Bar Association. So these are the groups that attend this meeting, these meetings. And House File 88, we also have Senate File 218, and the Senate, Senator Chamberlain, Peterson, Engelbrightson, and Weiger are the authors in the Senate. This is an addition to the Minnesota State Chapter Statute Chapter 364, which relates to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders. In 1974, the Minnesota State Legislature first recognized that criminal offenders should have the ability to be rehabilitated themselves and become productive members of society. Just a little background, this bill is about veterans getting jobs. It's not a mandate. It's not a preference, but it just creates another line of rehabilitation for veterans coming out of the military when they want to seek jobs and employment. The unemployment rate for Iraqi and Afghan veterans remains high here in Minnesota. The latest number from DEED shows that unemployment rate for veterans ages 18 to 24 is 10%. The unemployment rate for Gulf War, also for women veterans, is reported is higher at 13%. And so we do have our next generation of veterans coming back to our state from Afghanistan and Iraq. And we need to look at these barriers to unemployment employment for our veterans and break these barriers down. What this bill will do, Minnesota Statute 364.03, individuals have prior criminal conviction that show competent evidence of rehabilitation are not disqualified from public employment or occupation of requires the state issue license. Now, this does not apply to police officers, attorneys, or other, and there's other exceptions, if they show competent evidence of rehabilitation. This does not say that they're going to get an interview. It does not say that they're going to get the job. It just creates another line under the current statute that the DD-214 now can be show that there's rehabilitation has taken place. Now, any offenses after they are released from the military, if any offenses occur after that, this will disqualify them from using their DD-214. And I do have a guest here. We have Trista Mattis-Castillo, and she would like to just say a few words.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Committee members, thanks for letting me be here. I am Trista Mattis-Castillo, and I am the chair of the Women Veterans Initiative for the state of Minnesota. But more importantly, I'm also a veteran myself and the wife of a veteran. And so I want to give you an example, a very real-life example and very personal example of how this bill could affect a veteran. In 2004, there was a staff sergeant working for me in my command who had he was a combat veteran, a seasoned combat veteran. He was a staff sergeant from the Ranger Regiment. He was very experienced. He had served 13 combat tours in 57 countries. And in 2004, he was standing on his front yard in Lakeville, Minnesota, with an armed standoff with police. This was after he had believed he had been on a mission, of a room clearing mission, and he didn't realize exactly where he was. This was truly a cathartic moment of post-traumatic stress disorder. He was still serving in the National Guard at that time, and we continued to keep him in service. He went through a series of, obviously, as you can imagine, the criminal justice system, rehabilitation efforts. He did anger management and counseling and got help for his PTSD. The military retained him during that time, and we redeployed him one more time to Iraq. And not only did we redeploy him to Iraq, we promoted him to first sergeant. And I can testify that he is the finest soldier ever to have served in the Army. He led a group of infantrymen to Iraq to the El Anbar proverb, which is on the western side that they referred to as the Wild Wild West. And every one of his men came home. One of the only units in Minnesota that had every one of his men come home. That staff sergeant, promoted to first sergeant, is my husband, Hector Mattis-Castillo. And Hector has since left the military. He had an honorable discharge after 18 years of service and pursued his degree in social work. He's now a licensed clinical social worker, and he works for the Domestic Abuse Project and for the state of Minnesota Department of Human Services, where he runs programs for men who are abusers. He runs veterans groups, and he does counseling for other, both police officers and veterans who have post-traumatic stress disorder, among other mental health issues. And I tell you this story because he, obviously had his own intersection with the criminal justice system, followed all of the court's recommendations above and beyond, and continued to rehabilitate. But when he left the service, seeking employment has been a challenge every step of the way. It was a challenge for him to even get entered into grad school because his criminal record came up and they didn't know that perhaps he should be allowed to get a degree in mental health. At graduation, he had to approach a board just to take the licensure boards and exams. And as he went through every step of the way, he had to sit before committees and explain his story and revisit that story over and over. It's 2013, and just in December, he was officially licensed as an individual clinical social worker. It's an awesome story, but he's not alone in that story, and many veterans have some similar story. And what this bill will do is to say those veterans who continue to serve, they serve honorably, and are discharged from the military, they can use their DD-214 as one way to show that they have rehabilitated. We continue to ask a lot of our veterans. We put them through hard situations, and sometimes they find themselves in the crosshairs of the criminal justice system. But we don't give up on them, and we continue to serve. Hector made it through the process. It was an uphill struggle every step of the way. But it, let me tell you, the stress on our family and the burden of proof would have been a whole lot easier if this bill was already in place. I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I just want to say on a personal note, I am very, very proud. I've known Hector for some time, and if you're interested in seeing the story in much more detail, I was involved in a documentary called With Impunity that was shown on Twin Cities Public Television. And Hector's story is the focal point of it, that he went through the pretty much a living hell and came back and is doing just great work in Minnesota, and it's incredible. And both Hector and Trista have just been an amazing couple. It's been an amazing journey. If you're interested in seeing it, let me know and I can make it available to you. So questions about the bill, though?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, if someone has been convicted of a crime prior to going into the military and then is discharged, does this count for the crime that occurred before them entering their military service?
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. And the military is pretty, to get into the military today, you have to have a, they go through your records and everything. And if you are, if you did commit a crime and then enters the military, the DD-214 will show that you've been through the military, honorable discharge. That's what the purpose of this. It does not guarantee that you're going to get a job. It does not guarantee that you're going to even get an interview, but it shows that rehabilitation has taken place.
Isn't this the same as the certificate of rehabilitation that we, I don't know if we didn't pass it here a couple of years ago, but it's the same concept that we, does anyone remember the, that this would be an added dimension that would be looked at by an employer that you had made significant strides towards rehabilitation? Does anyone remember that?
Mr. Chair, there was a bill that would have allowed citizens with criminal records to go to a court, ask for a certificate of rehabilitation based on a pattern of good behavior and non-criminal behavior. That was not enacted. This would be similar to that. It would be a substitute based on your ability to serve honorably in the military for the duration of your commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Debo. Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, and if you look at Chapter 364, you know, it lists different things for that indicates that a person is rehabilitated. All this bill will do is just add the DD-214 to that list.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is that form then submitted to someone other than the employer, or does it do something to the criminal record within the database system, or is it just something that you then give to your employer and you say, I've been rehabilitated? I'm just trying to figure out the actual implementation of this.
Representative Dittmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, again, if you look at the current statute 364, the DD-14 would just be added to those other criterias. In this case, the person is coming out of the military, honorable discharge. Now he can use that in terms of trying to show that he's got rehabilitation has taken place. It just gives another line under the current statute. That's all it does.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then ultimately, if an employer denies someone a job, this would then be added to the reasons they would have like a cause of action against the employer. Is that what this does?
Representative Detmer.
Well, usually when somebody applies for a job, they will show their references and so forth. And if a person knows he's got a record, he would show his DD-214 too, show that he has an honorable discharge. It still is up to employer to interview people. It just allows because when you fill out an application, you have to state that you've had a criminal offense before. I mean, that's something you have to do when you apply for a job. And all the DD-214 shows that you've been in the military with an honorable discharge. That's all it does.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not a question, but more of a comment. Very proud to have my constituent, Tristan Matus Castillo, and Hector is my constituent here today, too. And I have to note that for this, thank you, Representative Detmer, for bringing this. Thank you, Trista, for testifying on this. Members, there's a book that some of you may have read, those in military circles have read, called On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, that indicates what it takes for us to condition our young men and women to be out on the battlefield and prepare to take a life in defense of this country. And the things that we do to them to put them in that position are extraordinary. And sometimes there is a complete failure to grasp what it takes to cycle back into society. And there's an expectation that everything's going to be just fine after that. And it doesn't happen that way. In this book, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman describes how there was a very, very low shoot rate in World War I, followed by World War II. But through operant and classical conditioning, they got that shoot rate in Vietnam up to 90% of soldiers on the front line willing to take a life for their country. Now, we see what happened to those young men when they cycled back stateside after the war. We see the impacts, and we see the complete failure that the society had to take care of those who we expected to take care of us. And we've come a long way since then. However, not enough. This is just one step that can be done in recognizing what we do. In World War II, members, 20% of this nation wore the uniform of our country at some point or another throughout it. Right now, it's less than one half of 1%. There is a need for these kinds of laws, but I think to go even further, other laws to establish and appreciate what we expect from those young people and also what we have to offer for them afterwards. So thank you, Representative Denver, for bringing this, and I'm very proud to have Trista here today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, I understand that you wanted to see this bill. I'm not sure what impact it has on the court, but we're happy to have it if you need to hear it.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, that's what I was trying to get at, what happens to the record, to see if there is a reason for me to see it. And, Mr. Chair, I am not sure that I do. I am supportive of this this concept, and I actually was supportive of the certificates of rehabilitation as well, Mr. Chair. The question that I just really want to make sure is that I understand which crimes that you still can have already been convicted of prior to being admitted into the military, because ultimately then what we are doing as a state is we are saying whoever the United States government takes, even if they committed many crimes prior to going into the military service, that this is assumed that they have been rehabilitated of all of them. And Mr. Chair, I just was trying to get a sense of how broad that scope could be.
Well, that's fine. Why don't we have it go to your committee then, if you want to have some more information about it?
No, I'm fine, Mr. Chair. I don't need to hear this one. You can send this one to the floor.
Okay, so then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I can answer that question for you. So the list of crimes that the military accepts for when they recruit changes over time based on the needs of the military. But in general, the maximum crime is usually a gross misdemeanor. The most often, and they still require a waiver, it's not an automatic for the individual joining the military has to prove that they also are rehabilitated. But typically, it is something of most often, and Representative Lesh, as a new officer in the National Guard, can probably testify that he's had to sign waivers. They're usually underage drinking kind of the crimes. Occasionally, they are financial crimes under the amount of $3,000. Anything over that, whether it's check bouncing or theft, they won't be brought into the military. We do not enlist sex offenders. We do not enlist someone who's committed murder or domestic abuse, because then there are other laws that says they can't carry a weapon. So we're not looking at violent crimes either.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, yeah, that clears it.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Matus-Castillo. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Okay, then in light of that, in light of what Representative Hillstrom said, Representative Detmer, Representative Schoen, would Could you remake that motion? Because now it does not. So why don't you move that House File 88 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill? Then we avoid the stop.
So moved.
Okay. Representative Detmer, you understand? Okay. Any questions on that?
Well,
do you have any closing
Chair.
Comments you'd like
to
make?
It would have been nice to go right to the House floor with it, but I know that's not always the case. But
yeah.
I appreciate allowing us to come in today to the committee. And this is one more step to recognize the men and women that are serving our country.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, excuse
yes.
me. Is there a reason that we wouldn't just bring it to the floor?
You know, I've had this discussion with several members here. We're just, you know, the most orderly way I've always had an omnibus bill, and where all of the public safety bills, it still has to get out of this committee at some point. And when the omnibus bill is on the House floor, it will be up to Representative Detmer and Representative Johnson, who's got a bill up today, and anyone else to defend their bill on the House floor. It's an orderly way to have all of the crime prevention bills or public safety bills heard at one time. If you want a bill to travel separately, we can probably make a motion at a later time to have this go to the House floor. It's just the way that at least we have done it in the past. I know Representative Smith did it. Representative Cornish apparently didn't do it the last time, but it's just the chair's preference here. But if there's a way we can, if they run separately, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm trying to get an orderly process here.
Okay. So will that be the same for all the bills that we hear today?
Yes, that they'd all be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill.
Okay.
And, you know, if bills, some bills won't get heard, if there's a fiscal cost to them that are going to impact our budget, it could be problematic. But I don't see this being one of those kinds of bills.
Okay,
so we have the motion, Representative Detmer. So all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Detmer.
You. Thank
you. Okay, we have Representative Johnson's bill next. And there's a Representative Johnson, do you have any witnesses?
Yes, I do. I have Assistant County Attorney from Isani County, Bob Bienick, and also from the 10th Judicial District.
Judge. And Representative Johnson, so the A2 amendment is yours?
That it is.
Okay. Okay, so the chair will move House File 228 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill, and the chair will move. Does this need to go somewhere? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so we have a different motion. Representative Johnson, why don't you make the motion? It needs to be passed and re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. So that will be your motion.
I will make that motion.
Okay, very good. And then, Representative Johnson, would you move the A2 amendment to get the bill? Tell us, well, first, why don't you move it and tell us what the amendment does?
I'll move the A2 amendment, just changes a couple minor things, adds buildings or dwellings in a couple spots, because it's in the rural areas, it's not just houses, there's also agricultural buildings that can be involved. And also adds as part of the in the penalties for violations, also adds demonstrable bodily harm in case a fireman gets injured, and also if in an evacuation, if somebody in the public gets injured due to causes of this fire.
Okay, very good. So Representative Johnson moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Mr. Johnson, do you want to tell us what the bill does? And
yes, Mr. Chair, members, this bill deals with wildfire arson. Arson itself is very difficult to investigate, let alone get a conviction on. If anybody's, I know there's a few to deal with fire department law enforcement on this committee, And you know how difficult it is investigating an arson fire, as most of the evidence is usually burned up, or unfortunately, due to extinguishing of the fire, the fire departments end up destroying a lot of the evidence. It's part of the beast in the way fires go. This bill deals with an incident that occurred in northeastern Anoka, part of Washington and part of Chisago counties. In 2009, it was a very dry year, and all the fire departments were concerned about grass fires that year. In 2009, a firefighter from the Forest Lake Fire Department set a number of fires in the Carlos Avery Wildlife Area and the surrounding community. The fire departments responded to the fires that were threatening buildings and dwellings, and a particular fire that he set in the Carlos Avery Wildlife Management Area came out of control. It ended up burning over 2,500 acres. To put that fire out, there were fire departments from over 30 communities that were involved, countless man hours of the volunteer fire departments. And you got to remember, these fire departments are volunteers, which means the personnel were volunteering their time away from their jobs to battle this fire. This bill came forth from the work of Assistant County Attorney Bob Bienick, and also the Anoka County from the Anoka County Attorney's Office, Wade Kish. Mr. Bienick was involved at this fire, working a water tender for the firemen, actually working the crew. And what happened was they ended up actually catching the person who started this fire. And after the conviction, it was found out that due to having no points on the sentencing guidelines, after a large fire like this, he was only able to be placed on probation. At this time, I'd like to have Bob Bienick explain the bill, since he was involved in the major involvement in getting this brought forward.
Mr. Bienick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. My name is Robert C. Bienick. I'm an assistant county attorney in Isani County. As Representative Johnson had indicated, I am here to testify in support of House File 228. What this bill does is it increases the criminal penalties in the case of a wildfire arson under Minnesota Statute 609.5641. It increases them where buildings or dwellings are threatened by that fire. It'll also increase the penalties where there's a specific number of acres burned. It also increases the penalties if there are crops burned to a certain value. And it also increases the penalties if someone suffers demonstrable bodily harm. My idea for this bill came out of what's become known as the Carlos South Fire of April 2009, which is the fire that Representative Johnson referred to. It was started by a Forest Lake firefighter, and ultimately burned 2,637 acres. And I am a firefighter with my local community of Hugo on a part-time, paid-per-call basis, and I did respond to that fire. Being in the criminal justice system at the time, I kind of, you know, watched the news and kind of followed the case, and I was kind of struck by the very low severity level offense that our system had to charge this this arsonist with. And it kind of started the ball rolling for me to try to figure out how we can make this better and just make sure that we can truly get justice in some of these cases. That Carlos South fire required 120 apparatus from 31 departments, and that represents all the fire departments of Washington and Anoka counties. I didn't get a firm number on the personnel, but if you figure at least two people per apparatus, you had 250 plus people involved, plus the support. I remember Salvation Army was out there to help. And there's all other, with a big fire like that, there's other groups that come out also. I think there were some state people that were on the way to that one too. Additionally, there was the DNR and the National Guard each had a helicopter using buckets of water to try to put this fire out. And the number of homes that were threatened by that fire was near 150 homes. And I don't know if that actual number had to be evacuated, and there's some various involvement that each of these homes had near the fire, but there was 150 homes in the direct path of this fire as it was marching along on a windy day in a dry April. So with all this, I began working on redrafting this statute. I got into some contact with some various groups of professionals, both on the fire side as well as on the law side. I spoke a lot with Wade Kish at the Anoka County Attorney's Office. I also spent some time with Gary Sigfrinius, who's the Forest Lake Fire Chief and was the incident commander on this fire. And I can report that this bill is supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, as well as the Minnesota Chapter of Arson Investigators, the Minnesota Fire Departments Association, as well as the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association. That's all I have, Mr. Chair, and I know Judge Meslow does want to speak as well on the bill.
Are there any questions of Mr. Banik? Representative Simonson.
Very brief, Mr. Chair. You talked about different agencies that are in support of the bill. I'm just curious where the State Fire Marshal's Office lands on this one.
Mr. Banik.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I know I've been in communication with Ms. Denise DeMars, who was formerly of the Minnesota, of the Fire Marshal's Office, but I don't know where they specifically stand on this.
Very good. Your next witness.
I'd like to have Judge Doug Meslow up testify, as he was the presiding judge on this case.
Judge Meslow, welcome back to Room 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I see many familiar faces, some new faces as well. For those of you who don't know, before being a district court judge, I served in the House of Representatives from 2003 to 2006, all of that as a member of this committee. And one of the parallels between what I was looking at on the committee on laws and crimes and what I look at now as a judge is that age-old question, let the punishment fit the crime. And how do you make that happen? And I can tell you that Representative Johnson fixes a situation where the punishment does not fit the crime. If you look at the contrast, right now it would be a second-degree arson for someone to start a fire that causes anything over $1,000 in property damage. And that means that the maximum penalty for that is 10 years in prison and a $20,000 fine. And if it causes only $300 damage to personal property, that carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. And yet in a situation that we've got here, regardless of the amount of damage to wildlife acreage, the maximum penalty is 5 years and $10,000. Now, that's an impact when you look at the maximums, but understand the problem goes deeper than that. And that's because in Minnesota, we have the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And that commission sets guidelines for judges with their sentences and bases those guidelines on what the maximum penalties are. As a judge, I have to operate within those guidelines. And legally, based upon a United States Supreme Court case, I can't sentence somebody to more than what the guidelines allow me to do. I can't go all the way up to the maximum. I can only go to the top of what we call the box that the Guidelines Commission allows. So if you look at a first-degree arson or a second-degree or a third-degree, all of those are significantly higher penalties under the guidelines than a wildfire arson. I was the judge who was assigned the case in the against John Birkin. Mr. Birkin eventually pled guilty in front of me. If it had been a first-degree arson, that would have been a crime that would have caused more than $10,000 of personal property damage. The expected sentence for that would have been 9 years in prison. I could have given him 9 years. Even at that next lower level, $1,000 worth of personal property damage, it would have been 4 years in prison. And even if it had only been $300, it would have been 2 years in prison. But because it was a wildfire arson, and because even though homes were threatened and evacuated, there was no damage done to any homes along the way, I could not send him to prison. That was not an option. I could hold a prison sentence over his head. I could give him jail time. And I'll tell you what I did was I gave him jail time and held enough over his head so that if he violated probation, I could send him to prison. It seemed like a pretty good strategy at the time. Trouble was that then immediately after he went on probation, he went out and committed a couple more felonies, was sentenced to prison on those felonies, and by the time he came back to me, my sentence was absorbed in those earlier ones, and I could not give him 5 minutes of prison time as a result. That would all be fixed under Representative Johnson's bill. That kind of problem would never occur again. And I think it's seriously in need of a fix. And so having had that personal experience, having dealt with the frustration of not being able to give somebody a sentence that I think they deserve, I would certainly welcome the kind of change that Representative Johnson has brought before you. That's everything I have, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to field any questions.
Thank you for testimony, Judge Meslow. Any questions of Judge Meslow? Okay, then, is there, Representative Johnson, do you have any closing comments?
I was just informed, Mr. Chair, that the bill was provided to the State Fire Marshal's Division and that we've heard of no objection to it.
Okay, very good. So, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question. It's actually a question for you, Mr. Chair. I know this bill has to go to other places, but I hope you would consider putting this in your omnibus bill as well. So do you anticipate, you know, having it back, or do you anticipate being able to put bills that are not in your possession in your omnibus bill, Mr. Chair?
Well, once it's traveled to the Natural Resources and Policy Committee, that it would come back here, or we would simply include it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Taken-Holtzie is keeping track of all of our bills, so we have an organized process at the end. Okay. And I suspect that our two committees are going to work very closely in our making sure our omnibus bills are, because I would imagine there'll be one day of crime bills that on the House floor.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I just am a strong supporter of this proposal, and I would hate for it to not end up in your omnibus
bill. It's not going to get lost, I can assure you that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Johnson remakes his motion that House File 228 be passed and re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson and Judge Meslow. Next, Representative Lesh. I'll do some other time. I just want to make an announcement that we have with us the ninth grade students from the Legacy Christian Academy. Where is that? Where are you from? Okay, welcome to the committee. This is the Public Safety Committee. Okay, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 84 be recommended to pass and referred to
Government Operations.
Government Operations. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is a bill that's been 6 years in the making. This is a bill that has been the product of negotiations with different groups, some of whom are very satisfied with the results, some of who are not satisfied, most of whom, though, would prefer their own version, as is the case with all bills that come through the legislature. But in this case, it has been a lot of hard work, and it has included the participation of people. Members, Minnesota is among the top producers of puppies in the United States of America, with some of the largest dog breeding kennels in the nation, housing 300 to 600, even 1,000 and more. Kittens are also mass-produced in Minnesota. Members, you may ask yourself, why is it that we got to deal with this? And I know that many members have come up here and say, don't get your hands on an animal bill. And I can absolutely testify that that's probably wise advice. But the fact remains that this issue will continue to return to the state capitol because of the repeated stories you see on the evening news about cases where both you and I would be disgusted at the conditions that people would treat God's creatures. So this bill deals with that. And with respect to the section that falls before this committee, Mr. Chair, Section 6, it creates criminal penalties that are largely a restatement of existing penalties in law. Now, you may ask yourselves, well, why are we doing this then? Well, because of another provision in this bill that allows for us to inspect and license those facilities. As it stands now, Minnesota is only a complaint-based state. You have to stumble upon it and see it. Representative Howe, in the previous committee, talked about stumbling upon situations where it was just a disgusting situation, a criminal situation that he had probable cause to enter the home. We have no probable cause to enter on a farm or a breeding facility right now. If this current system were to remain as it is, you would continue to see those stories on the evening news. But this bill gives us authority to license commercial breeders of over 10 adult intact animals and to ensure that the laws that we passed are adhered to. There are some local ordinances in the state of Minnesota, members, but there are only three counties that actually have those. There are some city ordinances, but as you can imagine, the vast, vast majority of irresponsible breeders are located well outside those jurisdictions and are free from any kind of inspection, regulation of humane treatment of these dogs and cats. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Dr. Lisa McCarter.
Ms. McCarter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Lisa McCarter, and I'm a doctor of veterinary medicine. As a veterinarian, I was directly involved with some seizure cases, cruelty investigation cases of many large number of breeding facilities in Minnesota over the years. And I'm here to testify and support passing the House File 84. As a veterinarian, I have two main reasons why I think this bill is extremely important and long overdue. The first is with regards to animal welfare. Almost every animal that I've examined from these large-scale breeding facilities has had very similar symptoms and conditions, some of which include poor body conditioning or being underweight, some of them to the point of starvation, matted coats, long-haired dogs with matted fur, fecal matter and urine stuck to their skin under their coats, wounds, scabs, overgrown nails, some with even deformed legs from living their entire lives in cages, severe dental disease, untreated ear infections, external and internal parasites of many species. In addition to the medical neglect these dogs suffered, most of them were extremely unsocialized and even fearful of what we would consider normal environmental stimulus for dogs and cats. Doors, doorbells, cars, phones, people's hands touching them, sometimes even to the point of being aggressive out of that extreme fear. I'd like to describe one of the cases I was involved with. It was a breeder of hunting dogs, so this is somebody who's breeding animals to be sold to the public. This was in Jackson County, Minnesota. 59 live dogs were seized on the property. Two were found dead, having starved to death, and necropsy reports confirmed that they actually starved to death, lack of basic food. This was an investigation based on a complaint made to the local sheriff. Again, a complaint-based situation. It was not inspected prior to that, as far as I know. One dog was euthanized immediately due to being severely emaciated or starving. He also couldn't even stand on his own and had really bad eye disease. Some other stats, 58 out of the 59, so almost 100%, were covered in fecal matter. 58, again, almost 100%, had moderate to severe dental disease. 43 of them had fight wounds. 22 were positive for internal parasites. 38 of them were underweight. 12 of them were considered emaciated or on the brink of starvation. 16 of them had skin infections. 15 had severe and painful ear infections where their ear canals were filled with pus. 3 of them had fresh lacerations on their face and ears and needed to be stitched immediately. And 2 exhibited aggressive behavior towards people and had been euthanized for that reason. These dogs were suffering severe medical neglect, which is abhorrent. As a veterinarian, I can't stand to think of that happening out there. The second reason I think this bill is important is for public health reasons. Again, as a veterinarian, we take an oath, and part of our oath is to help protect the public health and welfare of people in our community. And in particular, there are a fair number of zoonotic parasites that these animals can carry, and these are a particular concern because they can be transmitted to people. The filthy living conditions seen at these facilities, and coupled with the immune suppression the animals have of being stressed from overcrowding, pregnancy, and repeated lactation cycles, increases the incidence that these animals are infected with and shedding these parasites into the environment. Some examples of parasites include roundworms. Roundworms are passed in the feces of infected dogs and cats, and people can be infected by these parasites. Can cause blindness in children, CNS disease, and can infect other body organs. Hookworms is another parasite that can cause itching skin lesions in people. Ringworm is actually a skin fungus that can be carried and transmitted from pets to people and can cause skin lesions and is extremely difficult to get rid of once it's in your home. Sarcoptes is also an infectious skin mite that dogs can carry that can cause itchy lesions in people. Toxoplasma is an intestinal parasite that can cause anywhere from flu-like symptoms, and this is the one that can actually cause abortion in pregnant women if they're exposed. Giardia is an intestinal parasite that can cause severe abdominal cramping and diarrhea. And then Salmonella is a bacteria I'm sure you've all heard of that can cause very severe symptoms in people if they're exposed. There are probably many others too long to list today. Unfortunately, the findings I've described to you today are extremely consistent and predictable for any veterinarian examining animals seized from these large-scale breeding facilities across the state. The cases that have come to my attention are only there because people have seen cruelty and have reported it. Without the ability for inspections, there's just no way of knowing the conditions that are out there that no one is visiting. Not only would the passage of this bill protect the physical and social welfare of the animals, it would also help protect the people in our communities that come in contact with these animals that come from those facilities. So again, I'm here to urge that you pass this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. McCarger. I should have announced that we would allow about 15 minutes for proponents of the bill and 15 minutes for opponents of the bill. And if there's any time left over, if someone still wants to testify, that we would make that available. So are there any questions of Dr. McGarger? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. McCarver. That was a very powerful testimony. I'm just curious, how many situations like that have you encountered over the last, say, 10 years?
Dr. McGarver.
Mr. Chair, I was working with Officer Streff through the Humane Society for 3 years. I'm no longer working in that particular facility. During that time, I believe I was involved with at least 3 investigations as such. There were several others that I probably wasn't involved with because they were just too small a scale. So I have specifically had testimony for at least 3 cases in the 3 years that I was working at the shelter.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Johnson.
Doctor, I have a couple questions. Mr. Chair, Doctor. Was the facilities that the situations you talked about, were they required to be conformed to the USDA standards and the registrations?
Dr. McGarger.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information. I do know that there are certain USDA breeding facilities that have been brought to the attention of investigators, and the pictures are out there to show up, but to my knowledge, I'm not aware. Maybe Officer Streff could answer that question for you.
Mr. Chair.
Maybe we should bring him up now, because I understand he has to leave.
I would just note that I think there are 35 or 40 actual USDA licenses in the state of Minnesota, and we anticipate that there are multiple more, but maybe...
Mr. Streff, do you want to come up at this point, since you're the... You want to please introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Streff, and I'm the humane agent for the Animal Humane Society based in Golden Valley. And I've been employed in that position since about 1987. the Animal Humane Society is the largest animal welfare organization in the upper Midwest and arguably the top five in the United States. We have five shelters and five different cities serving five different counties here today. And we provide a variety of programs and services to people and their pets all across the state. And I'm here today to speak in strong support of HF 84. As a humane agent, one of my primary responsibilities is to respond to complaints and concerns from citizens regarding animals that are subject to situations and conditions that are alleged to be in violation of the Animal Welfare Chapter. It seems like a simple project, but it gets more complicated once these cases start to develop. I'm confident that you've all read or heard or seen or are somehow aware of some of the horrendous cases that have broke on the news recently. I understand that you're looking at some pictures now that were passed around. Most of those pictures I probably have taken, and I've been involved with thousands of cases and probably hundreds of cases involving issues of breeding, such as the issue we're addressing today. Some of these breeder situations are complex and difficult issues to address. A lot of it's due to existing language that's arbitrary and is not very lead specific. I've seen dozens and sometimes hundreds of dogs subject to environmental conditions here that those pictures would tweak your imagination on. Dogs that are stacked in cages, some are running loose, some breeding indiscriminately. Some of these dogs are sick, some injured, some diseased, some dead. A lot of it's due to improper sanitation, improper water, feed, ventilation, treatment, all of it which results in untreated sores, rotting teeth, and blindness, maggot-infested coats, overgrown nails, psychotic behavior. Much of it which is just a lack of consistent animal husbandry. Some of these environments require hazard material suits. We have to enter these properties with breathing aids, and largely due to the staggering amount of feces and urine odor that they produce, as well as potential pathogen. Minnesota currently does not have any existing language that specifically regulates commercial dog and cat breeding facilities. There are no required inspections. There's no licensing program. We are a complaint-based state. Someone sees a particular situation, they report it. I document that complaint. I subsequently follow up to look into the facts and circumstances that were reported. Typically, when I show up, these situations have already escalated to the point of catastrophic environment, and we have very limited options at that point when I show up at the farm. Existing law only allows me or local law enforcement to respond after the complaint is filed, and that's an important issue in front of this committee today. It's my professional experience over the better part of 26 years in doing this is that by the time I show up, it's typically too late. House File 84 will allow the Board of Animal Health to identify, to correct, and to prevent these catastrophic events before they occur. County-issued conditional permits, county-issued interim permits, they're not consistent. There's only two or three counties that have any type of a language that specifically addresses commercial breeders. Some of these permits, before or after they're issued, still require complaint-based problems or complaint-based issues before they follow up on a complaint. Many counties and townships, they have no animal control ordinances at all. Therefore, what goes on in that particular county defaults to state statutory enforcement, which is very broad and very arbitrary. And because of this, it's expensive. And this bill is going to save law enforcement, in my opinion, money in the long term. You take the example of costs associated with seizing animals from a breeding facility where a valid complaint was filed. And again, keep in mind that this is the only way I or law enforcement find out about these particular cases is after a complaint is filed and after we observe a problem to exist. Current law specifically states that expenses related to cruelty cases shall be paid by the county. This incentivizes the county to overlook the problem oftentimes, and they push it on to local humane societies or animal welfare organizations, and that largely in part falls on us. And these cases are becoming too frequent and too costly for AHS to continue that cost burden. The number of animals involved is typically directly commensurate with the cost of an intervention. You can imagine that on those pictures from breeders that have dozens, sometimes hundreds, and there are cases where there are thousands of dogs at a single facility. When something goes wrong and a catastrophic environment develops, state law requires those animals to be removed from that environment, and then the litigation proceeds from there. And it's staggering, the cost, as a result of the procedure and policy that we have to follow once those animals are in custody. The Board of Animal Health would have the legal authority to take enforcement action with the passage of this bill. There are several due process procedures in this bill. So that seizing animals is not the first step we're going to take. Contrary today, when I show up at these environments, there are limited options, and seizure is usually the last resort that we have to move on. There are many professional and reputable breeders in the state today. It is not our intent to ban breeding of dogs or cats. We're trying to regulate it to the extent that it ensures sound, healthy animals, not only the animals used for breeding purposes, but the puppies and kittens they produce once they're subsequently sold to the public.
Mr. Strapley,
I urge your support.
Oh, okay. I was just kidding. You were just finished. Because we had a couple of questions, and I want to give the opponents, and we have another proponent, I guess, that wants to testify. But Mr. Johnson, is your question to Mr. Strapley or the author, or do you just trying to get make sure we're fair here with time?
Mr. Chair, I just had a couple questions, that just trying to get some basic answers.
Okay, why don't we just, if you don't mind, because Representative Cornish has a question too, let's just, is there one more proponent of the bill that wants to testify?
There is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, real briefly then, who has that?
Dr. Jim Holbert.
Is Mr. Holbert here? Oh, okay, well then that's... Okay, then let's
submitted a letter, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the
okay. Well, Representative Johnson, then we'll let and then Representative Cornish, and then we'll take the opponents.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Streff, it's good to see you. I've worked with you on a few cases up in Isani County. The work you do is usually very very good. I'd ask the question: the situation that the doctor described. Was that facility USDA regulated?
Mr. Straff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know without my notes on that. I do dozens and dozens of these cases. However, as a point of interest, the USDA is not a required licensing agency. The breeder chooses that, and I am seeing that trend now be less and less because the USDA requires an inspection. And as of the advent of the internet now, everybody can sell point of sale, so they don't need a broker, and that's what the requirement is for USDA if you sell through a broker.
Representative Johnson.
Okay. And you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Streff, you talked about the reputable breeders and commercial people having these operations. With the facilities that the doctor and you've described where the bad situations are occurring, do you think actually think that these facilities would actually license themselves, or would they just stay under the radar and this would still end up being a complaint-based investigation?
Mr. Straff.
Representative Johnson, I think what you're referring to is the existing breeders now. Is this going to cover it, or is existing law dealing with those issues now? In my professional experience, the answer is no. If those particular breeders that are reputable and professional, I would assume they're already in compliance and they're going to meet any standard that this bill proposes.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, can I point out one item on that?
Representative Lesh, and remember, members, we're supposed to, this committee is supposed to be looking at the Section 6 of the bill, which is criminal penalties. I understand we want to understand the bill, but that's our responsibility. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. As Mr. Streff stated, there are not a terrible lot of USDA breeders in the state of Minnesota. There are a myriad, 36, in fact. There are a myriad of individuals who can sell off Craigslist or whatnot. Now, this there's a provision of the bill in terms of whether or not they could still stay under the radar. As was stated by Mr. Streff, many of them absolutely will comply with the law. There are a ton of good breeders out there. Most of them are really good breeders, and they'll comply with the law. If you have under 10, you are a hobby breeder under this bill. And in the previous version of the bill, we said that you still had to sign up to be licensed, even though you wouldn't be inspected, but you had to be licensed. We took that out as an olive branch to some folks that still had problems with it. Now, it does cause us some problems, because if you sell a point of sale, a puppy or a kitten, and you take it to the vet, and the vet, just like Dr. McCarger stated, finds out, wow, I have probable cause that there was horrible conditions affected upon this animal, and you go to a judge to have them sign a search warrant of the property, and the judge will look at the warrant and say, I can't sign this. You don't have probable cause. How do I know that they're not just a hobby breeder with under 10? So you can't gain access to that, and you won't have a warrant. So there will absolutely be some loopholes through which people can walk on this. But those are going to be the bad breeders already, and those are the people that we're going to have to catch by complaint-based ongoing. But we think this will help.
Representative Cornish and Neuberger, can you wait for your questions until we hear from the opponents, or do you want the author to answer?
Well, I'm in a hurry as long as I get to ask them.
You will, absolutely. Let's hear from the opponents of the bill now. Thank you, Representative Lesh. I have William Lozito.
Lozito's fine.
Oh, Lozito. And Kristen Smith and Valerie LeBeau are signed up. And, sir, if you can keep your testimony brief, we'd appreciate it so we can get done on time.
Born in Brooklyn, and I'll try to apply what I learned at birth.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is William Lozito. Hi, Mr. Lesh, nice to meet you. My name is William Lozito. Since 1972, I've lived in Bloomington, Minnesota. I was born in Brooklyn, been here just about forever. I'm not a dog breeder. I don't intend to be a dog breeder. Okay. I share the same concern that Representative Lesh and everyone else who's testified and everyone else who's supporting this bill. I share animal welfare. Okay. However, I oppose the bill. Okay. And I'll get into why in just a minute. Okay. My wife and I have 4 Siberian Huskies, and I'd like to. How do I get these passed around?
Right. The page will bring them. Okay.
There might not be enough for everyone, but. There's Chomsky, Mishkin, Tolstoy, and Chekhov. Okay. So we're dog lovers. Okay. I also want to show you that my wife, Diane, and I, each year at the Humane Society, we participate in Walk for the Animals. One day in the mail, their magazine comes. Our dogs are on the cover. Okay, so what is this dog lover? Someone who cares deeply about their welfare. What is he doing here opposing the law? And that's what I'd like to answer and do it as quickly as possible. It falls into two broad areas. Okay. Oh, I do want to mention one other thing. I'll pass. I'll just do it this way. If there's a book on dogs, I'm reading it. This one came out a week ago. I'm halfway through it. So I like to keep up on the breeds. I like to keep up on the animals. I'd like to keep up on all of that. Okay, but why do I propose the bill? Let's get into that. Number one, the legislation itself, and I'll get into that. And number two, the cost. And the cost relates back to the legislation. And again, I'll be as quickly as I can be. Okay, my impression, unless things change since last week, and by the way, last week, my name was called to speak, and the meeting ended before I got to speak.
Okay, you have your chance now, Mr. Gelizito.
Pardon me?
You have your chance now. Please proceed.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay. I oppose the bill because I don't see rigorous, objective analysis, research, and information. What I do see is a lot of anecdotal information. So, for instance, if it's 1% of dogs that are mistreated versus 5 versus 10 versus 20, it's a whole different story. We don't know the base because we don't know the number of breeders. So that's the problem I have with the scope of this. It seems like we're just being way too broad with it. Okay. Now, do I stand corrected in saying that as of the meeting a week ago, there was no due diligence done going county by county, municipality by municipality, and seeing what laws that exist that might apply. Has that taken place? Or is it more anecdotal?
No.
It's very disciplined, county by county, municipal
okay,
by county.
Okay, we have to go through the chair here somehow.
Okay, sorry, okay. Mr. Chair. I apologize for that. Okay, I will go through you. Okay. Okay, now getting to the cost, I can't imagine how we can determine the cost of something without knowing what is going to be regulated. Okay. I took an alternative approach versus number guessing the number of breeders, and it was an educated guess. I took an alternative approach. I looked at the land mass of the state of Minnesota. You probably know this better than I do. 83,574 square miles, 87 counties. I cannot imagine how four or five individuals cover the entire state. And therefore, I come up with a number in year one of $1,137,000. Do I think it's that number? No. But do I think it's the $500,000? No. So I really have a concern coming up with numbers based on pulling assumptions out of the air. Okay. A couple of more points. I'll be as quickly as I can. I'll skip over some things in the interest of time. Okay. What I did is I looked at the median family income, household income in the state of Minnesota for 2012. It's $57,000. I also looked at, I assumed the 30% tax rate is 2,000 hours in a year of work. And what I calculated that at the cost of this bill of $500,000 a year, one taxpayer would have to work 68 years, 7 days a week. So what I'm asking is, can we please consider how we expend tax funds and have it based on fact? Okay, wrap up, summary. Okay, I don't think the law should be based on emotion. I don't think the law should be based on anecdotal information. I don't think the law should be based on a rally at the state capitol. It should be based on fact and fact alone. And I'm going to mention a quote you probably all heard. Maybe it's been oversaid, but there's a famous U.S. senator. He said, everyone's entitled to their own facts. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. They're not entitled to their own facts. So what I'm saying, is there a way that both parties could work together? I'm not one of those parties. To shape this bill in a way to make it more acceptable to those concerned. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Lozito. The next person is Kristen Smith. Again, I mean, you can express your opposition to the bill if you want. Prefer that you talk about the criminal penalties, but come on up. This bill has a couple more stops, too, just so people know. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kristen Smith. I am representing the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association today. I'm not actually a dog breeder, but I'm an end destination. I have a pet store, and I'm the one who buys all the USDA puppies that are produced by the USDA breeders here. And I came to give you some information about the USDA breeders that I work with and give you some numbers as far as whether or not you feel or how you feel about this. I've been running this pet store for over 25 years, sell many, many puppies, really enjoy what I do, love the animals. There are many ways to show how you love animals, and matching the right puppy to the right family is a very, very fulfilling job that I have. I can give you numbers. Over the last 10 years, we have less than one half of 1% of the puppies that we sell as adults that have serious medical problems. The USDA breeders that we work with are doing a very, very good job. We enjoy what they do. The state of Minnesota is 16th in the country as far as number of USDA licenses. According to the numbers that I saw, we only have 33 licensed breeders in the state. USDA is also in the process of a rule change. The way the system is set up right now, I have a pet store exemption because people are able to come to my store and see the facility and see the animals. Because of the internet, and because of the changes in the industry, USDA is in the process of changing that rule so that if a person who's buying a puppy does not directly go to the facility, they then will be required to have the USDA license and apply and follow the same standards that the USDA people. I brought the USDA standards book. If anybody wants to see it, these are the rules that all the breeders that I work have to follow. Okay, and it's very comprehensive. In the last 5 years, USDA has really tightened up what they do. They have cracked down on the breeders. They have reduced the number of breeders from somewhere in the area of 150 in 2009. Now we have 33 left. So it's important. You don't know that the number of dogs that the perception is really out there. I don't know. We're sure not seeing it.
Okay, very good. Anything else?
I just wanted to say that the pet breeders were not contacted in the building of this legislation. And we would like to continue to work towards a compromise that is acceptable to all parties.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Valerie LeBeau, Mugley. I'm pronouncing that wrong, I'm sure.
Mugley.
Mugley. Sorry.
And while I'm speaking, I'll let some photographs of my puppies go around. So okay. Feel free to take a look at those, but they're the only copies I have, so you'll have to give them back to me.
Okay. We will get them back to you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. As you indicated, I am Valerie LeBeau Mugley. I consider myself a hobby breeder of golden retrievers. My dogs are pets as well as agility dogs. However, under the current proposed bill, I would no longer be defined as a hobby breeder because I do have more than 10 dogs and I do have more than 5 litters a year. All of my dogs, like I said, are pets, and they also compete in agility trials throughout the Midwest. For those of you who don't know what agility trials are, you may have seen on television obstacle courses where dogs jump over jumps, they weave through poles, they tunnel through tunnels, they go over seesaws. That's what my dogs do. I do what I do out of a love and a passion for the breed and for the sport of dog agility. I also donate some of my puppies to service organizations like Can Do Canines, who train them to be service dogs for the handicapped. And I do all of this, and still, I've been doing this since 2000, I still am operating at a loss. It's very costly to raise good animals and to do the job well and be able to make a good profit. But this bill is wrong on so many levels. You know, it used to be, I remember when I was growing up, that you had to be convicted of a crime before you got put on probation or parole, okay? This bill effectively puts dog breeders on probation and parole without having committed any crimes. It's motivated by false perceptions. It hurts business owners and consumers. It creates excessive regulation. It does nothing to protect animals that existing laws don't already address, and it's a costly expansion of state government. First of all, that is motivated by false perceptions. Radical animal rights extremists have created and successfully promoted a perception that all or almost all pets come from bad places, especially pets that are sold in pet stores. And I think that Kristen's testimony demonstrated that that just really isn't true. They think that they've promoted the perception that all large breeding operations are dirty, overcrowded, unhealthy, and that the people who are breeding animals do so out of greed. And believe me, there isn't a lot of profit in breeding animals. It just simply isn't true. In fact, the cases that Dr. McCarger cited are rare, and they're already being prosecuted under current criminal laws. Breeders that I know are for humane treatment. Humane treatment of animals. They care deeply for their animals, and like myself, they usually are operating out of love and passion for animals. They don't usually make a lot of money. They know it's in their best interest to keep their animals healthy and safe. And that's what I know about breeders. And I know breeders of all sizes, hobby breeders, medium-sized breeders, and large breeders. They're already regulated in over, if you have over three like dogs or cats, you're already regulated in all municipalities in the states of Minnesota. Registries like AKC, UKC, regularly inspect breeders who have, like in my case, my dogs are all AKC registered golden retrievers, and so I'm annually inspected because I have more than 7 litters a year. I actually have about 7 to 10 litters a year on average. USDA regulations. The people in this room may or may not know that if you sell one dog to a broker or a pet store, you have to be a USDA breeder. That means that you have to be under USDA regulations. Now, a lot of people don't know how stringent those USDA regulations are. The large breeders are under the USDA regulations, and for example, many of you have pets, and I bet some of you put a bowl of water outside for your pets, okay? If you do that and you're in a USDA operation, if you don't have a roof over that bowl of water, that's a violation. If you have a hairline crack in your sidewalk, it's a USDA violation. If your dog dug a hole in the ground and the USDA inspector happens to come before you get that hole filled in, that's a violation. The USDA regulations are very, very strict, and the people who are selling to pet stores and have large operations are already regulated under USDA regulations. The fact is we need large breeders because the hobby breeders cannot supply the demand for dogs in this country. They can't produce enough pets to meet the number of pets that are required. But the second point is that this bill hurts small business owners and consumers. Small business owners like myself, many breeders have gone out of business in states where bills like this have been passed. Iowa, Missouri, and Wisconsin have passed some of these bills. And these bills, first of all, are not paying for themselves with the inspection fees and things like that, but many of the breeders have gone out of business. In fact, I was at a breeder seminar where a USDA inspector has told me that about 2,000 breeders have gone out of business in the last 2 years. That's a lot. And you look like you want me to hurry
well,
up.
Well, please, I would like to please wrap up. I want to give members an opportunity to ask questions of the author before we vote on the bill.
Okay. Well, I want to just quickly, because this is public safety, I want to talk about how excessive the regulation is and how serious breeders like myself will be forced to make their facilities industrialized. Right now, my puppies are whelped in my home, and usually, like USDA inspections, you have to have impervious surfaces, you have to have certain facilities and stuff like that, so we won't be able to give them the homey type of atmosphere they have. Many small hobby breeders will put a couple of animals together once or twice a year, and to teach the kids or to make a few bucks or something like that. Those people won't be affected. But serious hobby breeders like myself, who are really looking at a breeding program for a specific breed, will be affected because it's not uncommon for us to have more than 5 litters a year or to have 10. And my prices, if this bill goes through, is going to go up substantially. $500 or $1,000 per puppy, and the consumers are going to be affected. But we're already being regulated under city, county, AKC, USDA regulations, and we're under this bill, they would also ask that our names be published, which we don't want our names published because we're already under attack by radical groups.
Okay, Ms. Moogley, you really have to wrap it up. I've got three members who have questions, and we're going to go beyond our time, I'm afraid, members. So
great. Well, just the last 2 points. It does nothing to address animal welfare concerns that aren't already on the books, and it's a very, very costly expansion of our state government. And it's not necessary.
Thank you for your
testimony.
Thank
you very much,
Ms. Moogley. Representative Cornish, Neuberger, and Kiefer.
Mr. Chair, out of respect for the time, I'll make mine real quick. And Representative Lesh, I want to make them. These are amendments I just advised. I'm going to support your bill just to get it through. I know it's got a couple other stops. But two areas, if you could look at for possible amending or wordsmithing. On page 4, subdivision 2, subparagraph C, The thing that bothers me about that, it says, if the license is suspended, revoked, or denied, the board must be granted access to the facility during normal business hours. If they're suspended or revoked or denied, they're not going to have normal business hours. And I just worry about coming back, how long they can do this. Just keep coming in. They must be granted access to the facility. I mean, what if it goes on month after month, or if it's in limbo, if it's being appealed, if you could just, and then the lack of a probable cause in that portion. Once you've done the inspection and then come back, if you could look at that before the next stop. And then on the next page on 5, subdivision 5 posting, the problem with that is that you don't have the reasons. And if somebody's looking for a dog breeder and they find this website, it could be, I just worry about it being a clerical violation or not filling out a report. Somehow they might be suspended temporarily, and they put in the website that this breeder is suspended, and somebody's looking for a breeder, and they don't even know the reasons why. It could look like they're maybe torturing pets or something. They don't know, and then they go by that business when it's actually a minor violation. And other than that, like I say, that I haven't had a lot of input from the ag community yet. Nobody stopped and saw me, but I'd support your bill for now, so thank you.
Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question, I think, needs to be addressed by the veterinarian, Dr. Lisa McCarger. If she could step up, that'd be great.
Ms. McCarger, real quickly.
You wanted to keep our questions based on Section 6. Section 6 is the penalties, but in order to apply these penalties, we have to go back to the standards of care, which would be Section 3. Because that is what our penalties are based on, would be violations of standard of care. As I just go through this, I'm going to be brief. At 515, line 515, it says a commercial breeder must comply. 518, it says a commercial breeder must insure. So we have these demands that are placed on commercial breeders, and where I really think we need to be cautious here, and we need to look at this, is when you jump down to 5.24, it says animals must be provided daily enrichment and be provided positive socialization. I was wondering if the doctor could, because this is a standard of care by which penalties are going to be ascribed, what is, on 524, what is the definition of daily enrichment and how is that measured?
If I could, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lash.
I did speak with the Board of Animal Health about this, Representative. They expressed concern of how do you enforce that? What does that mean? There's no question. It is difficult to determine when you walk in and an animal is inside, whatever, how have they been run, how they've been exercised, how have they been socialized. There's no question about it. But in keeping with that, also you can't prove it. It's if a person is going to be found in violation of this, it's going to have to be by a separate affidavit, an employee that comes forward that says, oh, and by the way, these animals were never exercised, they were never socialized. So that's really the only way that we can enforce this, not really by the inspections. And that's the information I have for the
Representative Neuberger.
Mr. Chair, if I could briefly.
Ms. McCarger.
Representative, the line 534, a commercial breeder must maintain a written veterinary care plan developed in conjunction with an attending Minnesota licensed veterinarian. I think that would probably help cover the scope of the other question, which was how do you determine that? And as a veterinarian, and yes, I only worked in humane investigations for a short time, but in private practice, I saw many animals brought to me that were adopted from, rescued from breeding facilities that were extremely unsocialized, and then I had to coach those owners with how to rehabilitate that animal. If a breeder is in a good relationship with a veterinarian, that veterinarian can help coach that breeder on a case-to-case basis on what to do for the pets and how to enrich them.
Representative Keefe, or Representative Neuberger.
I just want to say that on 524, that I think that this part of the bill needs to be better clarified.
Okay. Representative Lesh is taking notes on all of your comments. Representative Keefe.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to clarify. Someone said that animal welfare already has laws on the books for abuse. It seems to me like, and I don't like to see these pictures, they make me sick and I'm really sad it happens, but it seems like we're all focusing on commercial breeders, and I just want to make sure that there are laws in place for people that are not breeders, like, you know, the you always hear about the cat lady that might have 100 cats running around, and that's a bad situation too. Just want to make sure are there laws in place, and sorry if I don't know this already.
Mr. Strapp, do you have an answer to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, yes, there are existing laws on the books, but they pertain largely in part to individual pet owners. There's no specific language in the parameter of a commercial breeding facility that licenses or inspects. So when these events happen, they're much more catastrophic. You yourself, you might be a pet owner. If you have a problem, that's a dog or two. But if somebody has 20, 30, 40, 100, 150, and you see those photographs, that's the result when one of those collapse. So we'd like to prevent that.
Representative Kiefer.
Okay,
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I've heard from many small business owners in my district that it sounded very much like Ms. LeBeau Mugley had the same concerns. And so, Representative Lesh, I was just curious about a couple things. Did you work together with the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association, the Minnesota Council of Dog Clubs, Sportsmen's and Animal Voting Alliance, and a lot of the dog and cat breeders? And if you have or haven't, would you be willing to work a little bit more with them to kind of allay these concerns that these folks have, because the small business owners are going to be very much adversely affected by
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lohmer, yes, we did. Over the course of 6 years, we worked with the breeders. I understand some people got to the process late and weren't aware of the extensive talks that we had, but absolutely, and as late as yesterday, I was speaking with the breeders' lobbyists in my office about what they really needed out of this bill, what their concerns were, and how we could come to a resolution. Some of the testimony you heard before you today here was people who would actually not be affected by this bill because they're already regulated by USDA. This doesn't affect those folks that are regulated by USDA, or individuals who are already regulated by their local ordinances if they live in a city or they live in a county that has an ordinance. So absolutely we'll work with them. We want to make sure that it's effective for those who fall outside the loophole, though.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question on Section 4, who can initiate these investigations, and we're talking about a humane agent. I'm struggling with, first of all, kind of the definition of that humane agent, and from what I understand, there's really no oversight of that humane agent. We have oversight for the board, local animal control authority, and a peace officer, but where's the oversight on that humane agent?
Representative Lesh.
Well, this would be under the Board of Animal Health, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kelly.
What? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, that's not my understanding, though, of a humane agent from a definition, and I think as we ask research, they're not actual employees of the local board.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's a concern about this, I can certainly look at it. I will look at it.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiefer, last question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just something you said, Representative Lesh, is that the people that are already licensed through USDA would not be affected by this bill, and I don't see that. I see that they are still going to have increased costs, and increased licensing, increased chances of penalties. So I do think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think they're affected by this bill.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, you heard it was Ms. Smith who was up here and testified that the criteria for the USDA is very, very stringent. If you put a bull out, you got to have a roof over it. They're already complying just based upon that regulation.
Right. Mr. Chair, but they
Kiefer.
Still have to get the licenses in the state, and they still have to pay, and they still have to get the fees and renew every year and everything. This will be an additional step, even though they have the USDA license.
Representative Lesh.
Okay. Well, I understand that. I think it's nominal.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Considering
already doing
any further discussion? Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Lesh?
I will do so, Mr. Chair. I ask that this be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Operations.
Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. This meeting's adjourned.